Okay. Well, if you have your overall course outline, the one that has the entire course, we're in Roman numeral 4C, so we're just about through the historical summary up to the Maccabean period, and we're in C, which is the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And then just to show you where we're headed there, we'll pause and we'll take a look at the developments in Judaism up to this period, and then we'll pick up a little bit more on history, which takes us through the Maccabean revolt and up into the Roman period. And then we'll go through some of the more of the stuff that has been going on during this period, literature, what's going on in Judaism leading up to the New Testament. So we're still kind of in the historical background. So last week we really finished up Alexander the Great. If you recall, Alexander had gone through really quickly all the way into Persia to the borders of India, and he died young at the age of 33. And if you're keeping track, that was around 323 BC. So we're about, just for reference, we're about 100 years into the intertestamental period now. If you remember when we started back at the end of Malachi and where Nehemiah left off at the end of his book. So we're about 100 years plus into the intertestamental period. And I know some of you have been doing reading on the side and stuff. I appreciate that. And bring your questions. If you have questions and want to email me during the week, feel free to do that. One of the questions last week that we got was, we had talked a little bit about Plutarch and when was Plutarch writing. And he was born around 50 AD. So he was writing around the turn of the century in the first century AD, just to see how far removed. So he was about 400 years removed from when Alexander actually lived. We were referring to Alexander's biography. And one other note, you might recall that when we were talking about Alexander's siege of Tyre last week, how, remember the story about how he besieged it for 7 months and built a causeway over to the island fortress? Jack actually dug up a really interesting article this week that he sent me, and I'd be willing to send to anyone that would like to read it. But if you recall, I mentioned that is prophesied in Ezekiel 26, and it was partially fulfilled during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, but then fulfilled in a fuller way during Alexander's conquest and destruction of the city. Anyways, Jack dug up a neat article. I think it's entitled Tyre in Prophecy, and it was I think it sounds like an MA thesis or something like that, but it was interesting because the author was basically expounding on what I had said about how, well, it's really a defense of the reliability of Ezekiel and the scriptures. But as an example of that reliability, he uses Ezekiel and the conquest of Tyre because a lot of scholars have said, you know, that prophecy wasn't fulfilled, and he shows in the article how it was pretty much exactly fulfilled by those two conquests and then some subsequent wars that happened after that. So it's an interesting article. It's only about 10 pages. If anyone's interested, you could get it from Jack or me. I can send it to you. It reminded me, you've heard me say before that Daniel is often criticized or, you know, is often viewed as having been written during the intertestamental period because it so accurately predicts the events that happened during this period. Therefore, if you don't believe in predictive prophecy, it must have been written after the events happened. And the same criticisms are levied against Ezekiel, and it was interesting, this man was defending the reliability of predictive prophecy, basically, in Ezekiel. And all the prophetic books that actually predict things have that same criticism. It's a typical criticism nowadays. So, anyways, I wanted to let you know that's available. It's an interesting article if you want to read that this week. Okay, so just in review, we talked about how the information is very sparse during this period now that we're moving into the Diadochen period after Alexander. There's not a lot of information specifically about what was happening in Palestine. And you may recall, if you have your map from last time, that was from handout 5, you may recall that it was divided up. Alexander's empire was divided up into the 5 major areas. So it's actually, the Bible speaks about 4 in several places. And you can There's debate about which of the four are actually the ones that are referred to in the Bible, because it depends on whether you're taking an early view or a late view of the division of Alexander's empire. But anyways, this one shows the five rulers that emerged early on, and we talked about that last week. So that's kind of where we are. Now, at this point, let me see where we are in the outline. We're right at C on handout 6 now. So this sort of began the era of kind of craziness. All kinds of political intrigue, back and forth, and we'll read some sections from Daniel here today, I think, that will talk about that. But basically what happened is there was a continuing power struggle between Alexander's generals at this point and his successors. It's way too complex to get into the details in a course like this, but there were wars going back and forth. There was all kinds of political maneuvering. Generals defected from one side to the other. There were political marriages. You may recall some of those from Daniel. And then there were a lot of broken treaties and things like that. So what I'm going to give you here is a very, very simplified version of the kind of craziness that was happening during this period. If you refer to your map there, Antigonus, you remember, was sort of the one who took over Asia Minor after Alexander's death. And he emerged, as I said last week, as the main champion for unification. So he wanted to maintain the unification of Alexander's empire. And he pronounced himself and his son, Demetrius, as kings and co-regents of that area. And you'll hear these same names come up over and over and over again, and that's one of the things that's very confusing. Demetrius and Antigonus in particular, you'll hear those names over and over again during this period, and you always have to ask, which one are we talking about? But after they did that, that led to the other four satraps to also take the crown for themselves. So they all basically declared themselves kings of their areas, with a goal towards expanding each of their respective areas as well. So over the period, pretty much the next 20 years, the five main leaders battled for control of Alexander's empire. And that pretty much happened all the way from his death in 323 BC all the way up to 301 BC when a decisive battle happened that I'll talk about in a moment. So it was kind of like a lot of back and forth. Well, what happened is Antigonus and his son Demetrius were the main advocates of unification, and they wanted to absorb the rest of the empire. And Ptolemy, Seleucus, and Lysimachus, who are, you can see, are three of the names there, banded together against them. And basically, they banded together in a war against him and defeated Antigonus and killed him in 301 BC. And this was at the Battle of Ipsus, which is in kind of right in the middle of Antigonus's territory there on the map. It's in Phrygia today. You might recall that name from Paul's travels in the New Testament. It's right in Asia Minor there, right next to Galatia, if you remember from your Bibles where that is. Anyways, they defeated him. Now, there is an interesting note here. Ptolemy, who was the ruler of Egypt, had actually retreated prior to the battle. So he wasn't actually there when they defeated him, and that led to some issues later with whether he should be given a share of the empire or not. Anyways, they banded together and defeated him, and so that pretty much shattered the idea that there's going to be a unification of Alexander's empire. The Antigonids, as they're called, retained control of a small area in Macedonia and Greece at a later time. So they didn't actually get completely wiped out, but moved over back into the Macedonian area. So during this conflict, as you can see from your map there, Palestine was one of the main battlegrounds. And this will be true of the rest of the intertestamental period, as Palestine is basically the main battleground between the two major empires. And that would continue to happen over about, say, the next 100 years. So this was the period of the so-called Syrian Wars. So there were six distinct wars during this time between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, which is why that's the title of our section here. So that was about a 100-year period, if you can think about that. So at this point, you know, after the 20 years, so remember, all of this has happened. Alexander's spread of the empire happened in about 11 years. This battle for control happened over about another 20 years or so. So over a 30-year period, we've gone from Persian dominancy and rule to sort of a scattered Greek-controlled empire that is now going to divide into two main camps, the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria, Persia, and up in there, Mesopotamia. And so it's pretty much divided into two distinct periods. The period at the beginning is the period of Ptolemaic domination, and then later the Seleucids will regain control and they'll kind of take the power seat. So that's why in your outline here we've got D, the Ptolemaic domination of Palestine, is the first period. And that's where we'll go to now. I didn't hand out this additional map, but basically what happened is the Seleucids retained control of the eastern area on your map here. The Ptolemies took control of Egypt and Palestine and even up into Asia Minor. So it's kind of divided. Ptolemies here, Seleucids this way. Okay, that's kind of the division that happened. So at this, about for the first 100 years of this period now, the Ptolemies dominated control of Palestine, which is kind of where I'm focusing. I'm focusing on the Palestine area here. So some of the characteristics of this period then were, remember, so the Ptolemies are in Egypt, the Seleucids are in Syria and Persia, but they're all basically have, the rulers have Greek roots. So the rulers were Alexander's generals who were interested in Hellenizing the nation. And so even though they're rooted in these sort of ethnic areas, there's a strong element of continued Hellenization, the agenda that Alexander had begun when he spread throughout the world. And so in the Ptolemy case here in Egypt, this had a profound effect on world history, because the Hellenization of Upper Egypt centered around what town? Remember what town Alexander founded in Egypt? Alexandria. It's an easy question. Yes. Alexandria. Alexandria became the cultural center of this part of the world. It was established, as I said, by Alexander. He actually personally laid out the city on how he wanted it to be laid out. And it became, really, it became the sort of center for Greek philosophy and learning for centuries after that, down into the Christian era, actually. It was interesting. I think a lot of you know Ash Gerges when he was here, and he was from Egypt. And when I think of Egypt today, I think of Muslim, you know, it's Muslim rule. And I was talking to Ash one day, and he was talking about, you know, I said, well, what was your background? How did you become a Christian in Egypt? You know, and he said, well, my family was Christian and everything. And he said, Egypt was Christian. Don't you remember? Do you remember Alexandria? And I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. It was a center for Christian thinking in the early church. So it was an interesting reminder. We're pretty far removed from that today, but Alexandria was really a Christian epicenter in the early church. Okay, so what happened here, because Alexandria became an important center for Greek learning and philosophy, you may have heard of the Great Library in Alexandria. So Alexandria had the most world-renowned library in history. It had the greatest library in the ancient world, and it was founded by the first Ptolemy ruler, who we'll talk about in a moment. And it continued really for 1,000 years, if you can imagine that, well into the Christian era. And it reportedly contained hundreds of thousands of scrolls. And they just were like sponges. They copied every known writing anywhere in the world, including the Jewish scriptures, which is we'll get to later. I mean, it's just a remarkable machine that was copying and preserving manuscripts for 1,000 years. So that was the library. There was a museum there, which was really the forerunner of today's university. Museum, does anyone know what museum means, by the way? When you think about museum, you think about going to see things, right? Well, museum actually means temple of the muses. So it's a Greek idea that's also tied to the academy. So the academy in Alexandria was a meeting place for scholars. So you have this library, this museum, and the academy, which was really the center of Greek philosophy for a long time. I mentioned in the earlier part of the course, Philo is a famous Jew who wrote a substantial history and also some philosophy. He was a Hellenized Jew, basically. Philo was rooted here in Alexandria, Egypt. And then we have later the Christian influence. The church fathers Clement of Alexandria, you've probably heard of. Origen is another famous church father. Both of them were rooted in Alexandria. And it became famous for the allegorical interpretation of Scripture, which Philo does, as well as the Christian church fathers. So all that to say that Alexandria was founded right at this point in time during the Ptolemaic rule there in Egypt. So that was what was happening in Alexandria. Palestine, of course, was also Hellenized at this point in time. And it was generally peaceful at this time. I mentioned earlier there were a lot of Jews that were eager to accept the Greek way of life. It was viewed as a superior way of life in some ways. So there were a number of things that crept into Palestine here. The foundations of schools were laid, theaters, amphitheaters for Greek plays and whatnot, and gymnasiums. We think of gymnasiums as a place where you play basketball or have, you know, gym in school. A gymnasium at this time was actually a place where Greek culture was taught, and it was directly related to athletic sort of events. You remember when we talked about Hellenization earlier, how we talked about the love of the body and sort of the nurture of all that goes into that. So a gymnasium was a way to teach the young men, particularly, how to be a good Greek in terms of philosophy, way of thinking, as well as athletics. So that was creeping into Palestine over this time period. The Hellenization approach at this point that was put in place by the Ptolemy rulers was very tolerant of Judaism. So they weren't trying to stamp out Judaism or anything. They were just trying to sort of infiltrate it and bring the Greek way of life into Judaism at this point in time. We'll see that that's very different from what was going to happen later. Okay, so at this point, I would like to pause and read from Daniel sort of the background to this era here. Are there any questions? I'm just kind of talking really fast here. Jen? That's a good question. So where were the Jews during this time? We've got Egypt and Syrian and even Persian folks involved here. So you know from before that a lot of Jews never returned. And as a matter of fact, a return from the exile. So that would be in Babylonia and Persia. There's been estimates. I've read one scholar who believes that there were up to 1 million Jews left in the East who never returned back. And remember, we had examples of those people. Daniel, Esther, Mordecai, those kind of. Nehemiah was cupbearer to the king of Persia. So we know there were Jews in high positions in the Persian Empire, which was, again, one of Cyrus's policies that we talked about before. So basically, this is the time of the dispersion, the diaspora, you've sometimes heard it referred to. That means that there's Jews dispersed. So there's a large population of Jews in Persia. There's some Jews in Egypt, and there's going to be more soon during this period. And then there's also some Jews up in Asia Minor. But still, you know, Jerusalem is still viewed as the epicenter of Judaism at this point in time. Okay, so I'm going to read from Daniel chapter 11. And we talked last week about Daniel's prophecies in chapter 8 and chapter 11, how, if you've read this before, it's just like, what is going on here? What are we talking about? What is he talking about? And Pastor mentioned that he has his sermons online on these. If you want to go back and listen to them, he tries to explain some of them. And I'm not going to go through all the details here. So last week I recommended, if you want to go into details, read Daniel chapter 8 and 11 with a good study Bible or a commentary with you. And there's all kinds of details in here that a study Bible will bring out for you. I'm not going to go through all the details. I just want to kind of show you the general lay of the land here. So we're going to read from Daniel chapter 11. Remember, this starts off with the kings of Persia through Alexander, and then it goes into this period, which is the latter verses that I want to read. We'll read up through verse 13. I'll start in verse 2. Remember, Daniel is getting revelation here. And now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these. So I'll pause there. The first three kings there that are mentioned are Persian kings. The fourth that shall be far richer than all of them, if you recall, is Xerxes, who made war against Greece. And then a mighty king shall arise. Who's that? Alexander the Great. And he will do as he wills. As soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven. That refers to his early death and dividing up into the four winds of heaven, the four areas, okay? But notice what it says, not to his posterity. We talked last week about how Alexander had no son at that point in time, although he had one that was born later. Nor according to the authority with which he ruled. So this shows that there's a lessening in power of the empires, and you recall that also from Daniel's prophecies of the statue and the four beasts. The same diminishing of power is talked about there. Okay, now this brings us into this period. Then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he and shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority. After some years they shall make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure. But she shall be given up, and her attendants, he who fathered her, and he who supported her in those times. And from a branch from her roots one shall arise in his place. He shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he shall deal with them and shall prevail. He shall also carry off to Egypt their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold. And for some years he shall refrain from attacking the king of the north. Then the latter shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. His sons shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces, which shall keep coming and overflow and pass through, and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south, moved with rage, shall come out and fight with the king of the north, and he shall raise a great multitude, but it shall be given into his hand. And when the multitude is taken away, his heart shall be exalted, and he shall cast down tens of thousands, but he shall not prevail. For the king of the north shall again raise a multitude greater than the first. And after some years, he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. Okay, so you can hear the king of the north and the king of the south over and over again there. So the king of the south is the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt. The king of the north is the Seleucid king up there in Syria. Just so you keep that in mind. And we'll go back. I'll point out some of the details of this as we go through the actual people now that are involved in the world history here. So now, if you look at your other handout, I'm sorry for the quality of this. It's really poor. was a light colored thing to begin with. There's like a family tree on the back of your handout here. It's figure four. You can't really even see the connecting lines because it was like really grayed out, and I copied it as dark as I could, but it didn't come through. But anyways, on the left-hand side, you see the Ptolemies, and on the right-hand side, you see the Seleucids. What we're going to do here is we're going to focus on the Ptolemies down to Ptolemy IV. That's the first four rulers. Because, remember, they were in power at this time over Palestine. The Seleucids on the right-hand side, they were ruling simultaneously, but they didn't really have power of Palestine. And then right about that point, we're going to shift over to the right, and we're going to follow down the Seleucid line, which is the folks that came into power in Palestine at that time. So you can see there from the top that the first Ptolemy is the man we're going to talk about now. So this is the guy that's referred to in Daniel 11:5, and he was the founder of the Ptolemaic dynasty. So he was one of Alexander's generals, and he was assigned Egypt after Alexander's demise. He's referred to in 11:5 here, which we just read. It does talk about one of his princes that shall be stronger than he and shall rule. We're not exactly sure who's referred to there. The first Seleucid king there you can see on your family tree. During this period when they were warring with Antigonus, he had to take refuge in Egypt with the Ptolemy ruler for about 3 years until he could be restored to his kingdom after Antigonus was defeated. That may be who one of his princes refers to there. But he was a powerful ruler who established the Ptolemaic dynasty. On the back of your handout, you can see a coin that was minted during this period that has his image and has the inscription there of King Ptolemy. And so that's what the coins look like. You can see his handsome mugshot there on the coin. He was a very powerful ruler who established the Ptolemaic dynasty. He's the one who actually established the library at Alexandria. So it was under his rule that the library was established. And here's where I was referring to the Jews coming, Jen. He deported many Jews to Alexandria. And Josephus tells us about the Jews that he deported to Alexandria. And basically what happened is Alexandria became a strong center of Hellenized Judaism. There's been estimates that up to like two-fifths of the population, or at least two-fifths of the city division, the city was divided into fifths, and two of those fifths were Jewish quarters, I guess, but Jewish fifths. So there were a lot of Jews in Alexandria, which will become important under the rule of the next man. So at this point, not only was Alexandria the leading center of Greek thinking in the world, but it also became a leading center of Hellenized Judaism. Now, he abdicated the throne to his son in 285 BC. You can see there, I don't know if you can read those dates on there. This is an area where the dates are often off by a year or two, as I mentioned before, with the different ways of dating things. Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, is each of these had a surname or like a name that was added as a title. Ptolemy II, his son, enlarged the library that was established by his father. And it was under his reign that the translation of the Old Testament into Greek was commissioned. This is called the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, most likely the translation that was used by Jesus and the apostles in the New Testament. You'll notice in your Bible sometimes a quotation from the Old Testament in the New Testament doesn't read exactly like what the Old Testament scripture says. And that's because there's some differences in the Septuagint from the Hebrew text. And so sometimes you'll see a footnote in your Bible that refers to the Septuagint translation. So when Paul is quoting something, sometimes he would be quoting the Greek translation, which is a little different sometimes than the Hebrew text. So sometimes you'll see that note in your Bible. But anyways, that was commissioned during this time. We're going to talk in more detail about that translation later under literature, but that was an important event during this period in history. Now, Ptolemy II established a peace treaty with the Seleucid ruler in 250 BC, Antiochus II, You can see he's the third one down there on the right-hand side. And we're going to discuss that later. That's what was referred to here in Daniel 11:6 with sort of a detailed political arrangement that was made with family interconnections. And we'll talk about that when we switch over to the Seleucids here in a moment. The next Ptolemy was Ptolemy III, Euergetes. He ascended to the throne when Ptolemy II died in 246 BC. He invaded the Seleucid territory because of the breaking of a peace treaty with the Seleucid rulers. He actually conquered the Seleucid capital of Antioch. And again, we'll talk about that in a moment. After he invaded the territory and subdued the Seleucid ruler, he established a new treaty with Seleucus II there, who's the fourth one down on the right. And you can see that they're roughly equivalent in time there. And then that brings us to Ptolemy IV. Ptolemy IV and Antiochus III came to the thrones roughly at the same time. You can see they're kind of straight across from each other on the outline there, on the family tree. I'm going to read a little bit more in Daniel because it describes this period. So we read this a minute ago, but now you can hear. So Ptolemy IV is in Egypt. He's the king of the south. Antiochus III is the new Seleucid ruler. He's the king of the north. Okay, just keep that in mind when I read this. His son shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces, which shall keep coming and overflow and pass through, and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south, this is Ptolemy IV, moved with rage, shall come out and fight with the king of the north. And he shall raise a great multitude, but it shall be given into his hand. And when the multitude is taken away, his heart shall be exalted, and he shall cast down tens of thousands, but he shall not prevail. For the king of the north shall again raise a multitude greater than the first. And after some years he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. Now that great army with abundant supplies is going to be the end of Ptolemaic domination of Palestine. And Antiochus III is going to be the one who shifts the balance of power to the Seleucid Empire. And that's what is referred to in Daniel 11, verses 10 through 13. Now, these two rulers basically battled back and forth. Of course, Palestine is the main battlefield. It's right in between their two empires. Antioch was the center, was the capital of the Seleucid Empire. You remember where that is, north of Palestine. And of course, that Palestine is right in the traffic area there. Ptolemy IV, you can see, just like we've seen in most empires, we saw it in the Persian Empire, we saw it and we'll see it later in Rome, we see it here in the Ptolemies. This ruler, Ptolemy IV, neglected public business and basically lived a life of debauchery. He was known for his debauchery. And just like in those other empires, you can see when that happens, the empire starts to crumble and fall apart. Antiochus III, on the other hand, was more powerful and ambitious. And he pushed all the way to the Egyptian border, which is what we were just reading about there in Daniel. They went back and forth a little bit. Ptolemy IV reestablished his claims by defeating Antiochus in 217 BC. But Antiochus III, that was what we read about there. Remember when the king of the north went up and cast down tens of thousands? That was referring to that event. And then Antiochus III took final control of Palestine during a three-year conflict in which he defeated the armies of Ptolemy IV. And I'm going to cover that in a little more detail when we switch over to the Seleucids here, so I'll just leave it at that for now. This is in about 198 BC where they changed hands. Now, interestingly, as you can see from your sheet, even though the Ptolemaic power was essentially broken, they still had a number of rulers that stayed on the throne. And those of you who know Roman history will start to see the connection there between Egypt and Rome with Julius Caesar. You remember Mark Antony and Cleopatra? So Cleopatra is involved in this down at the bottom here. But you can see way down in the lower left, and you can't see the connections here, but Julius Caesar is actually there because he married Cleopatra the VII, which was of Ptolemaic lineage. And then we know that more things happened after that, after Julius Caesar was assassinated. But you can see the connection there. So you know from your history, Antony and Cleopatra, so that's related to this dynasty that was still going on in Egypt. Another thing you can notice, right after Ptolemy the V, you notice that it starts to split, and there's multiple Ptolemies going across. So whenever you see that in a dynasty, you know that people are fighting amongst themselves because there's more than one person who's claiming to be the heir to the throne. And then so what happens is a lot of back and forth. This guy's on the throne for a little while, but then his brother knocks him off, and a lot of that kind of stuff. So that's the Ptolemaic dynasty. You can see the same thing is happening on the right-hand side of the sheet, which is what we're going to talk about next in a little more detail. Okay, so the Ptolemies 5 and 6 are important because they were important to our study here because they were involved in the battles with the Seleucids. But the Ptolemaic reign continued all the way down to Ptolemy 12 when Julius Caesar essentially ended the dynasty with his conquest of Egypt in 47 BC. Okay, so how do we summarize all of that with the Ptolemaic Empire? Again, information about what was going on in Palestine at this period is very sparse. We're mainly getting it by inference and by incidental reference by the Greek and Roman historians. But it's clear that the Jews were under a strong and well-organized government during this period. Remember, this is about 100 years that I just described. So for about 100 years, they were under a very strong and well-organized government. The Ptolemaic rulers, of course, used Palestine for their political purposes. They weren't friendly just to be friendly, but they were generally friendly to the Jews, and they allowed freedom for the Jews to live according to their traditions and their religion. So there wasn't any compelling of them to adopt Greek ways of life or anything like that at this point in time. But the Hellenization influence that was begun under Alexander continued to grow over this period. And we'll start to see the Greek influence coming in. I mean, it really kind of comes to a powder keg in the next 50 years or so, which is what we're going to cover next. But it did continue to grow. And although Hellenized, really what we have going on here is the age-old conflict between the Syrian and the Egyptian Empire, the same battle that was raging in Old Testament times, with Palestine still as the battleground. Interesting how some things never change. So that's kind of the summary of the Ptolemaic domination. And at this point, we're going to start to look at it from the Seleucid point of view, which is the Syrian point of view. Are there any questions or comments at this point, or was it just so confusing? Go ahead, John. In any particular location, or the question is, with all of the wars going on, how were they able to Hellenize, and were they destroying cities and killing lots of people and things like that? Well, remember, both of these world powers, if you will, were Greek. So they had a common agenda. So they had that in common. They weren't enemies that way. They were just vying for power. And there wasn't much actual conflict that happened in Palestine. They pretty much were just marching through Palestine. So they weren't like stopping and besieging Jerusalem, for instance. There was a little bit more activity along the coastlands there. There were some skirmishes and battles along there, and battle for control of some of those cities along the coast. But in general, they had that common view that even though we're vying for power here, we both agree that the Greek way of life is the way to go. And so they were continuing to spread that philosophy. So what's going on with the Jews at this time? They're basically trying to maintain the rule of the high priest in Jerusalem at this time. You know, remember what we said earlier, that even though the Jews were under the dominion of other world powers at this point, they were given a large degree of autonomy. And although they weren't political rulers, they were allowed to retain the high priesthood. And so the high priest effectively became the ruler of the Jewish people at this time, because there wasn't a king. The king was the Ptolemy or the Seleucid and their governors. Yeah, right. There were a number of Jews that were starting to embrace Hellenization. And so there were a lot of overtures during this period. There was actually a lot of contact between the Jews and the Ptolemy rulers. You know, you can see, we didn't talk about it in detail yet, but even the commissioning of the translation of the Old Testament into Greek, there was a big connection there. Josephus has a long account of how that happened. It's probably partly legendary, but the fact is that there was a connection there between the Jews in Jerusalem and the translators in Alexandria at that time. So there were generally peaceful relations. I think the Jews were generally pleased with the Ptolemaic rulers. Of course, they didn't want to be ruled by anyone, but there was general friendship between the Ptolemies and the Jews. And as a matter of fact, we'll talk about the high priesthood later, but in the next period where we have this, where it starts to come to a head with the Seleucids, one of the high priests actually fled to Egypt and they established a temple there in Egypt. So the fact that they could do that meant that they were on decent terms with the Ptolemaic rulers. Any other questions about that or anything about this period? Okay. We're really out of time, so I'll probably stop here and just tell us where we're going. But what we're going to do is pick up the Seleucid rulers at this point. This is a much shorter period. So the Ptolemies were in charge for about 100 years. The Seleucids were only in charge for about 30 years. The events that happened during this next period are really the catalysts for the Maccabean revolt, which is what we're building up to here. So we'll cover the Seleucid rulers. And what happened is this culminated in a major persecution in Jerusalem. And we should be able to cover all of that next week, I think. So that'll bring us up to the point of the Maccabean revolt, at which point we'll pause on your major outline there, and we'll look at the developments in Judaism leading up to that period. And we're going to focus on two key areas: Hellenization, what that actually means, what specifically was going on in Israel at that time under the Greek influence. And we'll also look at what was happening with the Jewish priesthood throughout this era. So we'll pause and look at those two things before we pick up the Maccabean revolt.